And we are here in the Santa Fe Baking Company today to pay tribute to a wonderful artist, filmmaker, pioneer in improvisational comedy, Ted Flicker, who passed away last Friday, the 12th of September. Joining me here in the Santa Fe Baking Company are Linda Durham, who is a former art gallery owner and consultant, Jonathan Richards, who's an actor, writer, and political cartoonist, and joining us by phone are Joan Darling, who is an actress, film director, teacher, and Paul Moore, award-winning sculptor, and all of whom have a few things to say about our dear friend, Ted Flicker. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
Hello.
Joan, darling, you knew him for a really long time. You did work together both on stage and in film. Tell us about how you met Ted Flicker and what he was like.
Well, first I have to say that Ted, those of us who know and love him and had the privilege of spending most of my life with him in it, he was like an artistic tornado. He just came into your life and with such energy and such enthusiasm that he would carry you along with him. And I met him because he had been conducting an improvisational theater in St. Louis, and my best girlfriend was in that theater. And when Ted came to New York, he wanted to start an improvisational theater, and my friend told Ted, "You have to audition Joan. She's perfect for this particular kind of thing." So I remember walking into the office, and he was sitting behind a desk looking very, avuncular even then. And he said, "Well, let's get started." And he gave me a situation to improvise. He said, "It's the jungle." So I immediately jumped out of my chair, sat on the floor, and slapped at a bug and scratched it, and then looked it up at him and said, "What time is it?" And he said, "It's 10 o'clock. And I said, "Oh, my God, they're starting early tonight." And he just stared at me and said, "Did you mean that there were bugs and that they came at the same time every night?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You're hired." So that was how we began. Needless to say, it was a wonderful meeting of the minds. And, you know, when you say, what visions do you have of him? And there are so many in my head that are so beloved. But one I'll never forget, when the Premise opened in New York, it was the first improvisational theater to open in New York. And we did our opening night, and we were very shaky because we didn't cheat. We didn't write sketches. We really did improvise, and we were learning how to do it. And we had a party at somebody's house. I think it was George Siegel's house, and waited for the reviews. And I remember Ted walking in, ashen, and saying to us, "It couldn't be worse." And then reading us this terrible review. And then he said, "We're going to keep playing this show because I know it can succeed and I know it will be good." And, of course, the next morning, the rest of the reviews came in and they were all raves. But it was, you know, his just, if you didn't know him, it's so hard to describe the kind of positive energy and the unwillingness to be defeated by anything that he was.
Talk a little bit about those early days of improvisational comedy. I think many of us take for granted that improv comedy is something that's always been there, but I mean, you guys were really working in the early days of that genre.
Well, Ted was really one of the total pioneers in it, although other people have gotten sort of more press about their place in the thing. But Ted had a company in St. Louis. He started in St. Louis, and he brought he was going to bring Mike and Elaine to New York, and he came to New York and he couldn't raise any money to do the show. So Mike and Elaine started performing in nightclubs, and so that was the beginning of the improvisation coming to New York. And Second City was not at all on the scene at all at that time. And then Ted put together the company of the Premise. And when we opened, like I said, we really learned how to do the show. I think one of the early positive reviews said it's sort of like Johnson's dog. It's not that he how well he walks. It's that he can walk at all. And that was sort of like us. And, I, you know, when you say what funny stories do I remember, and now that marijuana is becoming legal all over the place, I could tell this story. But we decided, we were so nervous and scared about it when we first started, that we decided we would try one night to get stoned. And we recorded all our shows. So we all smoked a little pot. We went on the stage. We did the show. We thought we were wonderful. And then we listened to the tape the next day. And for the 4 years that the premise went on, nothing passed anybody's lips prior to a show, not even an aspirin.
That is very
and
very
I, you know, and I remember just the four of us sitting on the floor and laughing in disbelief at how awful we were. And then, you know, another story, and this has to do with both Ted and Barbara, that my husband and I had moved to California. We were going broke. We couldn't get arrested. We had signed a lease, and my, you know, on an apartment we couldn't afford. And my husband called up and managed to get us out of the lease, and then called Ted and said, "Could we come and stay in your guest house for a couple of days?" So Ted said, "Sure." So we moved all of our stuff out of the apartment, and they lived in a house that had a main house and then a walkway and a guest house. And my husband was walking up the walkway carrying a mattress to a storage room, and Barbara was coming from the main house and walking by, and she said, "Oh, hi, Bill." She said, "What are you doing here?" And Bill said, "We're moving in." And Barbara said, "Oh, great," and kept right on walking. And so we moved in, and then they wouldn't let us leave. Ted said, "Well, you might as well stay here, and then you can babysit our house while we go and do the film." And then, of course, when Ted got ready to do the film, he immediately gave us both jobs. And so that was, and our relationship, the four of us, was like that all through our lives. There was a time when they had a problem, we were able to step in and help them out. So Ted and Barbara, too, have been our family. They're our family. And I think one of the nicest things, Jonathan, for me, was when we, Jonathan and I, did a play of my husband's called Callback, which is the story of basically my life in the theater, and it covered much of Ted and I together. And Ted came to see it, and I so much wanted him to see this particular piece. It's about a character who goes from 18, two characters, Jonathan, of course, that go from about 18 to 60. And at the end of the play, when we were taking our curtain call, we looked out, and there was Ted sitting in the audience crying with joy to see Jonathan and I, and to see that story told. So that was, for me, such a wonderful moment to feel that I could show this to Ted, to show him our lives.
The film that I think you're talking about is The President's Analyst, which is a film that I somehow came across in the 1980s, and I loved it so much that I rented it from the video store again, borrowed somebody else's VCR, made a bootleg copy of it, and proceeded to watch it a sort of semi-infinite number of times. And you, of course, Joan Darling, are in that wonderful movie. But that movie is an icon of the late 1960s. It was made in 1967, never really got the recognition it deserved because it was withdrawn because of objections by J. Edgar Hoover.
Ran afoul of the director of the FBI, yes.
Yes. But I would just like to recommend it to all of our listeners.
Yeah, I wanted to say that one of the interesting things about that film was I teach at the Sundance Directors Lab every year, and there are a lot of wonderful directors that are quite prominent that I work with. And the man who directed Soap Dish and The Last Station, I was having a conversation with him and another director, and I happened to mention casually The President's Analyst, and they both almost started to cry and said, "That was the movie that made us want to direct movies." And I just immediately ran to the phone and called and told Ted that.
Well, and it was so prescient. I mean, when you, some of our listeners haven't seen it yet, but I mean, if you think about what's going on now with the NSA and spying on Americans,
oh, yeah.
It foreshadowed all of that, what, 40 years ago.
Yeah, and it also, in a way, foreshadowed a lot of what happened to the hippies.
Right.
You know, the scenes, I just saw it again, I guess maybe about 3 or 4 months ago, and I hadn't seen it for a long time, and its depiction of that part of the American culture, the scenes in the van, aside from being hilarious, were so accurate, not only to what was going on then, but what happened in the future.
Well, it should be said also that although it does presage the NSA spying and that sort of thing, that's not what drove J. Edgar Hoover crazy. What drove J. Edgar Hoover crazy was that Ted cast the head of the FBI and all the FBI agents with the shortest actors he could find.
Right.
And apparently when Hoover saw that, he went ballistic, and there is a long story about Hoover having the film shut down. But Ted always said that he was grateful that he did not know at the time about the dresses, because he said if he'd known about that, he probably would be dead by now, as he is, but before this.
He didn't put him in a dress.
So, Jonathan, what was the nature of your work with Ted Flicker?
My relationship with Ted was all play and no work. We met through some mutual friends, Elliot and Susan McDowell, back in about 85 or 86, when they had just moved to Santa Fe, and when the Flickers had just moved to Santa Fe, but still were maintaining a foot in the door of their California life. And I remember Ted saying to me sometime around then, early in our relationship, that it was lucky for me that I had not known him a few years earlier in his full Hollywood incarnation, because he said he described himself as a type A personality and totally impossible to be around. Now, Joan, you'd be able to speak to that.
Well, I can. I mean, what I used to say, and I'll have to censor, I'll have to change the word, but Ted could not resist saying "screw you" to the Lone Ranger.
It wasn't screw you.
but what happened was that Ted really was an auteur, and he needed to have his own store. And whenever he had his own store, he was amazingly successful. But he did not play well with others in authority who knew less than he did. And so he ran, and he was not a man to make compromises. Plus, what you're talking about, Jonathan, in the old days, there was a kind of hair-trigger seduction that would unleash the fury of Ted. You know, and it was something that, as he matured, he realized, I think it's why he, Linda, you can speak to this, but for the longest time he kept the sculpture basically private, because he didn't want what he used to call old Ted to come in and get between him and the artistic experience he was capable of. And I think that was, you know, for those of us who knew and loved him and saw him bump up against what you have to do if you want to be successful in Hollywood, which is to make artistic compromises that often are just horrifying, that he found an art form where he could own it and really bring his power of expression purely into play.
Paul Moore is joining us by phone, and you, Paul, are a sculptor. And what happened? How did you meet Ted? Did he approach you and say, teach me your art?
Yes, actually, actor David Huddleston brought him into my studio, and as soon as Ted walked in, he started walking around looking at my art, and he said, I like this one, I hate that one, I like this one, I think that one stinks, and, you know, he was just giving his opinion about my artwork, and I knew right away I was going to like Ted, because he spoke his mind, and I like people like that, so he asked me if I would give him some lessons, because he'd like to learn how to sculpt. He's always wanted to sculpt from the time he was young, and he had time now, and he was, I believe, 63 or 64 when he wanted to start learning how to sculpt, and, you know, sort of a young man's game, and, you know, in my opinion, but Ted was determined to learn it, so we sat down and started giving him lessons, and he said, you know, I've got to, you know, you got to charge me for this, you know. And I said, no, I'm not going to charge you. And he says, well, he says, you know, I'm a wealthy guy. You can charge me and I'll pay it. I said, no, because if I charge you, I have to charge everyone else that I give, you know, lessons to. And he said at that moment he knew he and I were going to be great friends because I was being fair to him and I was straightforward with him. And that was really the basis of our whole relationship, was just the honesty of saying what we thought back and forth to one another. And sometimes you didn't want to hear his advice, you know, but he would give it because he really cared about everyone. And he cared about what happened to you, and he wanted to try to help you if he could. And that's the thing I really admired about Ted. He helped so many artists in all different fields. And, you know, he continued to have his fingers in the film industry by talking to writers and directors and trying to give them advice on what to do. And he was a mentor to a lot of people. I greatly respect him for that, you know.
Linda Durham, you have been in the art business for a long time. We've known the different incarnations of the Linda Durham Gallery. How did you find Ted and his work, and what happened? And what happens to his work now? I mean, he has this huge
yes.
body of work of sculpture.
It is. I met Ted before he moved to New Mexico, Ted and Barbara. And so I've known them their whole Santa Fe life. And they were collectors, and they were clients of mine when I had the gallery. And Ted was never did the work that was right for the kind of work I was representing. But when the gallery closed, Ted and I continued to talk about art, and we were good friends. So I was one of the people blessed to go to lots of the parties, lots of the luncheons. And in the past year, Ted did some consulting with me and asked me, we talked about his sculpture and his work, and I was encouraging him to be a studio artist, not to do too much to try and promote his work himself. And so he asked me if I would come on and represent all of Flick Fair, which is a beautiful and impressive sculpture park on their property, and to create a reputation for his work and to sell it and to write about it and to fix the website. So we were working together almost every day all summer long on his work and on reinventing Theodore J. Flicker and turning him into Ted Flicker.
Ted Flicker, the sculptor.
Yes, he changed his name to that.
Ah, very interesting.
I'd like to also add, going back even before you, Paul, Ted's first sculpture teacher was my stepfather. Ted took my stepfather Harvey Feit's sculpture course at Bard College back in the 50s. And interestingly, my stepfather had also made the same transition from being in theater and giving that up because he wanted an area where he could be working on his own and, you know, without having to depend on, you know, cues and entrances and being hired and that sort of thing. So Ted's initial foray into sculpture was back at Bard College in the 1950s under the tutelage of my stepfather, Harvey Feit.
Mm. Amazing. Paul Moore, was Ted a good student? Did he learn quickly?
Oh, he, like everything Ted did, he put his heart and soul into it and, you know, taught himself everything that he knew. I was just there to give him advice. And, I mean, Ted taught himself how to do digital film editing when he was, I think, 81. So that shows you, you know, the guy never would stop. He always was interested in learning something new. And, you know, most people, when they hit their, you know, get 65, 70, they're looking for retirement and they kick back and take it easy. But Ted's always on the go, just eager to learn everything he could. And when he did anything, he'd put himself into it 100%.
Well, I remember just a couple of months ago, standing in the yard watching him learn how to fly a drone. And I think one of the things that was so wonderful about him was this enormous energetic curiosity about everything. He loved everything. He was a fabulous photographer. He wrote a couple of books. He had a mind. You would go to visit him and hang out on the porch, and he had a mind that had just chewed up everything there was to find out about widgets, and he would tell you all about that. And he just was a kind of force that woke you up and made you want to do artistic things.
I agree with Joan. He was a great, great scholar. And one thing I wanted to say about his sculpture, because a lot of his subjects were his friends, artists in the community, and also biblical subjects that he liked, or mythology. But whenever he did a sculpture of one of his friends, he always put them in a context that was so big that almost mythologized them in a beautiful way. And his sculpture park is a truly synergistic place where all those amazing sculptures turn into something that's somewhere on the far side of amazing.
Well, we hope that they get to be seen by a greater public in the coming years.
Yes.
And I want to thank all of you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Joan Darling, Linda Durham, Paul Moore, and Jonathan Richards. And Ted Flicker, wherever you are, I'm sure you're shaking it up.
Yes.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
And here's just a little clip of an interview with Ted Flicker from several years ago.
I think it's inspiriting for a woman to be a muse.
Is your wife your muse?
Has been from the moment I met her. I mean, she has taken a very, very stressed life and turned it into a living art for us. She ain't bad, Barbara.